Welcome to Fascism in Cinema, the podcast where we explore how representations of fascism and anti-fascism operate in film. I am Tenzin Eagle, and with me is my trusty sidekick, Nathan Litvin. And we are joined today by Ting Gao, academic, who studies religion, politics, and gender, and author of the book Politics of Love, and co-host of the podcast In Betweenness. And Eddie Wang, who is a former student of mine and also a critical theorist and member of TETSI, which is an experimental translation collective. And the link for Ting's podcast and Eddie's experimental translation collective will be in the description of the podcast below. So how is everybody doing today?
Good.
There's no major global events that are happening right now, so we can just pass over.
No impending nuclear conflict.
Yeah, there's no pandemics that threatens everybody's safety or global nuclear threats at anybody's door right now. So there's nothing really to talk about in terms of politics.
That's right.
What's the situation? Ting is in Hong Kong at the moment, and what's the situation like there?
So Hong Kong is entering into the fifth wave of the pandemic, and we were doing relatively okay in the first 2 years because we had good experience from SARS some years ago. But now with Omicron, it's difficult to contain, as the government did before, and we are seeing a huge increase in the cases on a daily basis. And Hong Kong is also recovering from kind of social upheavals, the protests and the kind of police brutality and all that in recent years.
As I think I mentioned to you once before in our pre-chats, I had a job lined up in Hong Kong, and I got the offer like way back in November. And at that point, Hong Kong was still relatively good for its reputation about how it had dealt with COVID. It didn't look that bad and looked like a nice place to go. But it's just descended, you know, first through hibernating more and more and more, protecting itself from Omicron. And then, of course, that didn't work because trying to be COVID free is like trying to keep water off of the salt ocean floor. And now it's just experiencing this sad, tremendous like surge, which is probably causing so much suffering for the people who live there.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
A recent news article I read was that Hong Kong is now like the worst place on the planet to be for the COVID situation. And I was like, what's my luck? Like the one place that's offered me a good job and it's just decimated.
I don't know if it's the worst, but the situation is pretty bad. If you are like people like me, we are doing relatively okay. It's just, I think for people with low income and refugees in Hong Kong, that situation is quite damaging. Yeah.
Yeah. What's it like, the situation in Toronto? Eddie, anything crazy happened there?
Same old, you know. The convoy stuff wasn't a really big thing here.
They did have some big protests there, right? Though I saw some on the news of people gathering in the streets.
Yeah. Toronto's a good protest city. Lots of different protests. There was a lot of peace in Ukraine protests.
Those have been happening over the past like week with more frequency.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah. It was just at a graffiti alley, which is like this graffiti alley in Queen Street. And like they have a bunch of beautiful street art, which is basically like peace in Ukraine. And one was like, fuck Putin, you know.
So okay, that's nice. Do you guys think that Putin will be successful in getting rid of all the Nazis in Ukraine? I'm making light of a horrible situation. I don't mean to, you know, make light of the suffering. But his rhetoric that, like, he's going to go into the Ukraine to denazify it was just such itself a fascist and Nazi-like thing to say.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's quite typical of these tyrants or these authoritarian leaders to use that excuse.
Yeah, it's horrible.
Yeah.
It is pretty amazing what the Ukrainian people are doing over there. I'd argue it, you know, the sort of things they're doing has almost the status of the political event. They're just opening new possibilities of resisting essentially fascist invasions, which I don't think we've seen since, I don't know, the French Revolution or May 68 or whatever big political events we're seeing, the sort of unified front we see there is just totally inspiring. My partner's Ukrainian and like her family's in Kiev, so we've been like totally just glued to the news essentially every day and just calling, you know, and making sure everyone's okay. Morale is very high. Like, it's obviously scary out there when Putin's bombing civilians, but it's like the morale of Ukrainians are like, we're going to win this, you know? And like
No, I was just going to say, I wonder what would happen to that morale though, if the Russians succeed in catching Zelensky, because he is being, you know, bravely standing up to them and it's working ideologically to help garner a lot of support in the West.
Well, I mean, he's already a symbol, right? I don't think what happens to the flesh and blood Zelensky is going to change the resolve of Ukrainians.
Yeah. And also, yeah.
It's going to be, there is no way long term Russia can't win this war. They very well may grind Ukraine to, you know, rubble and ashes, but they can't win this war ultimately, I don't think.
And I mean, yeah, I think like the primary motor of Ukraine's success is with the people. Like they're just, you know, so devoted to defending their country and defending their way of life, you know, like.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ukraine has had a good foundation with civil society since its independence. They have rounds of protests and the civil society foundation of them that will sustain the people with or without a political leader, per se.
How would you, Nathan, characterize the political regime of Putin right now? Would you describe it as proto-fascist, authoritarian, totalitarian? How would you frame it?
It's definitely an authoritarian regime that is moving towards something that we would consider to be totalitarian. I mean, we have to be cautious using that term because that term itself is a concept that is contested, you know, within the philosophical and political literature around things like fascism and communism. But definitely the society that Russians live in today is not even as free of a society as they lived in, you know, only a few years ago. It is becoming increasingly difficult for them to say anything outside of the official party line. And so, I mean, whether it's fascist or some kind of new hybrid authoritarianism is hard to say at this point. Ideologically, it's a mess. And, you know, and you could say fascism itself was always an ideological mess, but, you know, it's hard to say without hindsight what it is at this point, I think.
So why do we have all these guests today? Well, because today we're doing a double feature in two parts. In part one, we are going to discuss Kiyoshi Kurosawa's The Wife of a Spy, 2020 release. And in part two, we're going to discuss Taiki Waititi's Jojo Rabbit from 2019. The reason for pairing these two films together is that both films offer a critique of fascism. Both I would define as anti-fascism. And also both are set in the same approximate period between 1940 to 1945. But whereas The Wife of a Spy is set in Japan, just as it's entering the Second World War, Jojo Rabbit is set in Germany during the last couple years of the war. And aside from that major alignment, both films offer very different ways of critiquing fascism, the former appealing to human suffering as a means of critiquing fascism, which I want to get into, and then the later, as we'll get into after, by straight up mocking fascism and ideology in general. What we find in A Wife of a Spy is a critique of fascism that appeals to human suffering brought on by war. And what led me to think about this first way of critiquing fascism was a few weeks ago, a friend asked me if after we did The Birth of a Nation, if I thought Quentin Tarantino's Django Unchained was, say, an anti-fascist film. And I said no, because I think, and this will be something for a later episode perhaps, But the way that Tarantino uses violence has a hint of a fascist aesthetic that I think he learned from, say, Sergei Leone and spaghetti westerns. And I don't mean that his films are fascist, but just that he's got a bit of a fascist aesthetic in the way he uses violence that he kind of learned from films like The Good and the Bad and the Ugly. But again, that's something for something at a later episode. But it just made me start to think about what exactly would be an anti-fascist film. And then I stumbled upon Das Boot, 1981, a film by Wolfgang Petersen on Netflix one night. Have you guys seen that movie, Das Boot?
Yeah, it's a great film.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, it follows like a Nazi submarine U-boat crew as they fight for their lives kind of, you know, deep underwater off the British coast. And they're in this like small little container in the deep into the ocean, just like raw suffering down there as they're like attacked and kind of struggling for their lives and bored out of their minds and just waiting for the next attack. And, you know, usually World War II movies, ones that become big box office successes or become legends in some way, the Nazis are the bad guys and the Western dudes are the good guys. But this portrays pure suffering on the face of the young German men so effectively that you end up almost praying that they don't die and that they win. I thought it really showed how ideology just melts away in the face of true human suffering.
There's another, not necessarily a genre, but another type of anti-fascist movie that focuses on individual like love stories, emotions, to use that love story as an kind of example of human tenacity, humanity, and all that. Thinking of, I don't know if you have seen Sweet Francais. So I think that film was made by, I don't think it was a Hollywood film, but it was about the story of a German officer who fell in love with a French woman in the village that the troop occupied. We see that quite often as well. You can see humanity through two people's love struggles.
And that's sort of like, that's been there since the start of basically anti-fascist cinema, like Hiroshima Mon Amour the quintessential love's anti-fascist story. It also reminds me of the quote by Thomas Pynchon in Gravity's Rainbow, which is "Fuck the war, they're in love." Just think.
But yeah, and in fact, we see that in both films that we're going to be discussing, which is an interesting connection between the two.
I want to throw something out loud that I'm just thinking off the top of my head here, though. If love stories in cinema can be trusted, say, as a critique of fascism in and of themselves, simply because love stories can be galvanized for any particular narrative of cinema, depending on the director's intentions and the overall plot, because love stories appeal so directly to our humanness, right? That they can be used to trick us, like in Birth of a Nation, like a love story runs throughout there to conceal the racist, agenda of the KKK, basically, right? And makes you empathize and sympathize with the suffering white women. But then when you step back and you look at it, you're like, wait a minute, this is being used to draw me in to support the KKK. And I wonder if, what I want to suggest, there's this quote by Emmanuel Levinas that I thought in relation to my conclusions of Das Boot, which is the epiphany of the face is ethical. And the way in which in Das Boot, they zero in on the suffering by zeroing in on the faces of the young men that almost makes you see through the ideology of, say, Nazism or whatever, and just see the raw humanity suffering deep underwater as they're facing their own death. And maybe the extent to which a love story can be galvanized to be anti-fascist is the extent to which they also, say, zero in on the face and the humanity of it and then don't draw it up in the service of some broader ideology. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, well, because the love story arc is in itself a narrative, mm-hmm. right? And so maybe there's a difference between being able with the camera to in those rare instances to show the emotion of love in a way that's not captured entirely by the narrative arc of a love story, but the love story itself, it's a piece of cinematic construction, right? Like it's a motif.
That might be a good way to put it. That maybe what I'm trying to say. So that if a love story is used in the service of a narrative, that it can be put to work for ideological ends, whether it be fascist, communist, capitalist, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if it's used to draw attention to the face and to the suffering of humanity and their loneliness and their quest for, you know, otherness and being in contact with some others in the relationship, mm-hmm. then it can be used to critique ideology. But it's a very subtle distinction, because it can be so easily used, you know, especially in big box office productions often today, you know, to support neoliberalism or support some sort of ideological end. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And also, even within a love story, these are two individuals. They have their own backstories. They have their own personality. They have their own agency. So whether that is portrayed in that film, in the film, or in the narrative, I think that's something also matters.
I also think, like, it also has to do with the structure of the love itself. Like, there are some love stories, you know, there's like some, you know, the basic rom-com love story could easily be co-opted to a sort of fascist cinema. But like a more complicated love story, like, for example, Hiroshima Mamoru, which is all about this confrontation of difference, this fragmented ugliness, which is innate in the experience of love. And so far as love always contains, as psychoanalysis tells us, the experience of ambivalence. Like that itself already brings us to the face, right? Like love as a confrontation of the other, of radical difference. What Irigaray would say is sort of the beyond of my conception of you. That's like the locality of a love which brings us to the face. Whereas like the love, which maybe Zizek would critique, of fantasy or projection could easily bring us to this fantasy idea of a unified state or so on. It reminds me of how Lauren Berlant in Desire/Love distinguishes between the sort of normative narratives and dominant narratives of like heteronormative capitalistic loves, but also like more radical, like queer loves, which are all about these non-homogeneous, difficult, challenging stories. And those difficult, challenging stories ultimately, I think, always bring us to the face and maybe to anti-fascist humanism.
Yeah, I like this. Thank you for bringing it up, Ting. The notion, I hadn't actually thought of that in my notes, but how love stories can be. And I think this is a really nice segue here, because there is love stories in both these films, and they're both used in these films. Well, do you think, Ting, do you think the love is used in The Birth of the Wife of a Spy to critique fascism, or does the...
Like, Wife of a Spy is not exactly a film centered around their love story, but there is a, I think more so it uses a gender perspective to critique fascism. I think in one of the interviews, director said that for him, the wife, exactly wife of that spy in the film, that she represents some kind of awakened woman in cinematic history, that she's no longer just a suffering person. That like for him, cinema quite often uses the female figure or the person of color figure as an embodiment of suffering. That's the end of the narrative. That's the end of agency. But in Wife of a Spy, she actually awakens from the suffering. She's actually taking control, basically, of her fate and the fate of those who suffer from Japanese fascism in the film. That she wants to be a spy as well. But my own interpretation, of course, is quite different. So for me, I feel that she's still quite subordinate in the narrative of that anti-fascist ideology.
What are you accusing me of? I've only come to buy raw silk.
容疑は何ですか? 彼は聞いてを買い付けに来ただけです。
弁明は本部でお願いします。
He says, give your explanation at the headquarters.
This is absurd! What has Japan become?
彼はイギリスの商人です。政治的なことには関係していません。
So by way of a summary of Wife of a Spy, I'll just keep this brief. Wife of a Spy is from the director Kiyoshi Kurosawa, who has directed many films, but is perhaps most known for The Cure, 1997. So he's also known for the genre of horror, and he's influenced by directors like Tarkovsky, Kubrick, and Hitchcock. And I can definitely see some Hitchcockian themes in Wife of a Spy, in the way in which there's like kind of a psychological melodrama kind of baked into the plot. Cinematographically, the film is beautifully shot. I think a lot of research went into the dress and locations and kind of the mise-en-scene of each shot to make it as historically accurate as possible in early Japan in the 1940s. So the main plot revolves around four central characters: the lead female, Sotoku Fukuhara, played by Yu Oi, hope I'm pronouncing that right, and her mysterious husband, Yasoko. Satoku's childhood friend, Teiji, who works for the fascist Japanese state, and Yasoku's nephew, Fumio. So at the beginning of the film, we are told that Yasoku's international import-export business is being watched by the government because of its close interactions with Westerners. Satoku begins to grow suspicious that Yasaku is having an affair after one of his business trips, and she learns instead that he is leaking information about humanitarian abuses of the Japanese state to the outside world. He and his nephew have made a video of Japanese state biological experiments. Satoku reports this to her childhood police friend, Teiji, which in turn leads to Yasaku's nephew being tortured, and then inevitably a big fight between Satoku and Yasoku. Nevertheless, the married couple seem to make up, and they plan to secretly flee to America by hiding on a cargo ship. And however, when Satoku tries to escape in a cargo ship, she is caught and then spends the rest of the war in a mental asylum. At the end of the film, bombs are dropping on Japan, and Satoku cries on the beach, having basically lost everything. Maybe it's important to note that this is also our first in the series, Fascist in Cinema, our first female non-white gaze film as well. All the films we've covered so far kind of maybe have a certain white male gaze to them. But what we have in this is a very feminine non-white gaze, which kind of itself maybe functions as a form of anti-fascist critique as well. So maybe this would be a good spot, King, maybe to jump back in there with...
But maybe to begin with, could you tell us to start with what attracted you to this film and why you wanted to bring it up for discussion?
Okay, yeah. So I grew up in the PRC in China. So I grew up with anti-fascist films, but made by the Chinese state. So that genre of anti-fascist films are mainly portraying male heroes, of course, but also centering around kind of the anti-fascist ideology, but represented by the state only. You rarely see kind of glimpse of humanities. You rarely see love stories. You rarely see these individuals and their own emotions, whether they question or whether they resist, how they resist as individuals. We only see them as really brave, courageous, but also just extremely unified under one singular ideology. And on the other hand, that whether Japanese government during World War II, whether that could be framed or understood as a kind of fascist government, that's still subject to debate, I think. But the military aggression definitely, I think, was fascist, and Japan occupied Korea since the 19th century and then occupied China and then Malaysia. So the fact that the film is made by a Japanese filmmaker, written by Japanese writers, so that is quite interesting, because I think nationalism is on the rise, populism, nationalism all over the world. We see that in Russia, we see that in the US, so we see that in China, and we see that in Japan as well. So that filmmaker and the writers of the film, they probably could be understood as maybe on the left wing of Japanese intellectuals and artists. So the fact that it's the Japanese who make an anti-fascist film about Japanese fascism, I think that already interests me, really intrigues me. I'm interested in how they will represent this, how they will show, demonstrate their kind of the anti-fascist ideas. It would be kind of equivalent of seeing a German-made film about anti-fascism, about fascist Germany, I guess, in the West. So I saw that film with great interest. And also the leading actors and actresses of the film, they are hugely popular, really pop stars now in Asia at the moment. So that's another reason to see this film. And the role of Satoko is really interesting because the couple, the protagonists, the couple of the film, they are kind of upper middle class of the time. And so upper middle class women at the time, they kind of were the leisure class. She didn't really have an occupation. So finding her passion in anti-fascism, that was something really exciting for her. That also is a bit sad, just a reflection of the reality of the time, the historical reality of the time. Although as an educated, wealthy woman, but she couldn't really find her social role in the society. So that, I think, is an interesting reflection, critical reflection. And then, but she, for me, I think I failed to see her role as a decision maker. She largely followed her husband's decisions, anti-fascist ideas, and it was his decision to board that particular ship, and it was his decision. He basically tricked her, left her behind. But she didn't have the social relations. She didn't have the means to become a spy in herself. But the ending of the film is also interesting. That made me think that she did have her own agency, so to speak. She was kind of the awakened one, because when the whole world was going crazy, bombing and everything else, that she was this really calm, really awakened, almost spiritual figure in the asylum, witnessing the whole world going crazy. But she was there being in as if she knew all along. So I think that ending was interesting. That ending, I think, gives her more credit.
I think that is interesting in the way it connects with your earlier point before the summary about how love can be used to critique fascism, because maybe an argument could be made that what's happening with her character throughout the story is that her love for Yasaku overrides any ideological commitment, right? So it's like she rats on him and his nephew because she's basically hurt about the possibility that he was cheating on her. Then when she finds out that he'll forgive her and they can still be together, she almost profusely apologizes. She just says, you know, I just want to be with you. That's the only thing I want. And she kind of has this, you know, very girl-like affection for him. Like, she just adores him. And that then she's willing to go to America. And then she ends up, of course, in the asylum. And then in the end, as you note, she's, you know, crying on the beach, having lost everything. And it's almost as if the only thing she wanted all along was the love. She never really cared about the ideology anyway, either way. Right? She never had any ideological commitments, per se.
Do you think, Ting, that she's driven? So she watches the film. What then is her motivation love, or is it, you know, a sense of compassion for the victims of this, or is it a complicated mixture of both?
Yeah, I would say a complicated mixture of both. Because for the propaganda, consumer propaganda at the time, so for anyone to be able to realize the suffering of the others, the other side of the story, I think that was already quite courageous and takes some kind of guts and intelligence as well, I would say. And I think she did have genuine maybe compassion, and she did have genuine commitment even to the anti-fascist project. But she saw life and the ideology through her relationship with her husband. They doing something together. I think that's the part of the thrill and also part of the passion and compassion as well. Although for her husband, I think it was only, he's almost like a lone wolf. His wife almost was like a burden for him almost that he had to get rid of. He didn't envision in his kind of idea of a project, the anti-fascist project, there was no place for her, or maybe no place for women altogether. So I think that there's a critique in there as well. The kind of fascist projects, all politics, basically, are quite gendered. They're basically led by in fascism or authoritarianism. Totalitarianism is quite often kind of quite patriarchal, quite paternalistic. Then the other side, the anti-fascism or activism can be as patriarchal as fascism itself. So I think there's a critique there that's quite interesting.
I have another way in which I want to introduce that anti-fascism functions in this film, that I got this from, say, some deeper reading on the theory behind some of Kurosawa's films, which is that he has a very Heideggerian way of using the camera to subsume action to time, so that both the characters and the viewers are forced to pass through time in his films rather than be affected by action. So, like, I'm thinking here of, like, you know, in big box office productions, right, like Schwarzenegger movies or Stallone movies, the entire storyline is subsumed by action. Action determines the nature of time, right? Like shot by shot, it's the action that structures time. But in Kurosawa's films, action is subsumed to time. So particularly in The Cure, the narrative is like forced to be manipulated by time in a way that you're forced to like wait through the moments. And it happens in this too. Like in this film, Wife of a Spy, the middle part is drawn out in this long way, almost kind of the building of a suspense that you almost start to wonder, like, is anything going to happen in this movie? And on my first watching of it, I, not knowing much about the director at the time, because I researched the director after, I thought maybe it was a result of poor directing. But then after, I was like, well, maybe this is his whole thing. He subsumes the narrative to time in a way that allows it to distort the action. And then it's like the human, the psychology of the characters is shaped by the long drawn out shots and the long drawn out moments.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, I mean, that the tradition that you're citing here is slow cinema, right? So you're talking about, you know, Tarkovsky, Béliard, that kind of thing. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that on viewing, and now I want to go back, you know, and revisit it and under that lens, because I think that's pretty interesting. Because you're right, in Western cinema, so much of the editing is based on action, right? Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I think it functions as a form of anti-fascism because it subordinates any particular character or ideology or male hero, say in the genre of like the Western, right? Like in the Western that I covered in our last episode, it's always the male hero that determines the entire arc of the story, his arrival, his saving of the damsel in distress, and then his restoration of whatever homeland or nation he helps restore. But in a film like this, ideology, characters, even the, you know, say sacrifice of a lover to the state or something is subsumed to time in a way that's almost annoying to the viewer. Like you're almost kind of like annoyed because you want the action to like pick it up and like take over, because that's what we're used to in these, you know, big box office productions that usually, you know, like superhero movies, for instance. But here it's like the destructive element of time wins out. And in the end, we're left with nothing but just like a girl crying on the beach, which is much closer to life.
That's an interesting observation. I'm thinking if that's kind of... if, as you were saying, if that's part of the kind of anti-fascist purpose, maybe that's just knowing the viewer, forcing the viewer to feel how maybe boring it actually was during the war for both sides. Actually, that's some historians pointed out, and to feel the maybe internal struggles of somebody who's very ready to do something, maybe anti-fascist project, but the internal struggles that happens is not just by direct actions or very active actions, but by very slow or very boring, almost sitting through time.
Yeah, I do feel like the sort of slowness of time formally is a site of critique of fascism, right? Like, you know, just thinking of sort of the history of film theory, a lot of early film theorists always located the temporality and passage of time as cinema's site of radical potential. Bazin famously described cinema as change mummified. Meanwhile, you know, Walter Benjamin would describe fascist cinema as precisely the more quick, sort of rapid fire washing through the masses type of cinema. And I think there's also this level, which I noticed when watching the film, the sort of slowness of it was reminiscent of how sort of Italian neorealist films shot action. So like there's a famous comparison where like a Hollywood film would have this primary subject catapulting the plot over, and you know, you would cut when the actor leaves the frame and cut to where they're going, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But what the neorealist films do is, you know, they have the long take, deep focus, which I noticed again and again in this film, which showed everything. And then when a character left the frame, the camera would just linger for a second and you would see the characters in the background walking. And like, when you see that, you're like, oh, right, we're always in social reality. We can't escape to this fantasy of the heroic subject, right? And that was a formal technique I noticed in the film as well, right? Like lots of deep focus, lots of long takes, just showing people living their life in the background and planting us and constantly reminding ourselves of the sociality these characters in the upper middle class exist in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that brings me back to what I'd said there at the intro about Tarantino, which in order to unpack and justify, I'll want to spend a whole episode at some point in the future talking about a Tarantino film.
Yeah. But back to, yeah, definitely in terms of theme and the way that violence is depicted. But, you know, also I want to hang on to this idea for a minute longer about the editing, because I think there's something there. You know, in comparing that, you know, the typical Hollywood blockbuster, you know, quick edit, mm-hmm. action-oriented edit versus, you know, what we've been saying about letting the background, letting life into the film through really long takes.
You really definitely see that in Tarkovsky.
Yeah. Or Béliard is my favorite example of this, right? Satan Tango, Werkmeister Harmonies, you know, like, really letting the world in Béliard's films, I think, is definitely part of a kind of a critique of authoritarianism. And, you know, I think there's something of this in this film, too, that I really want to go back and review it again to see it more closely. I think that in action, because I think, you know, that there is something about that rapid editing, you know. And Eddie, you mentioned Walter Benjamin, and I think there's something there about, you know, in order to keep the audience stuck in the ideology of the film, you have to keep them moving from edit to edit. And when you stop and you allow, you know, the emotion and the real humanness to come through, you know, and you allow the world to come through, the ideology starts to crumble. Because you're no longer, as an editor and as a director, I think, in control of your audience's reaction to the same extent. Because there's so much more there to see and feel that, you know, from the perspective of a director or an editor, you are no longer in control of. You know, and that's not to say that the cinematographer still doesn't have a lot of control, you know, and that blocking and there are other techniques through which there's still a lot of control being exercised, but even for a director and an editor to let go, to pull back in that way, I think is a powerful way of kind of destabilizing ideology in film.
Right. And that, yeah, that reminds me of, like, that's Bazin's main thesis, or one of his thesis, right? The idea that if you let the viewer have complete freedom in the frame, what it shows to them is ultimately that reality is ambiguous, which is pretty anti-fascist. Although I will, you know, I'll also say there's also the tradition of cinema, you know, from Eisenstein to even Benjamin, who would advocate for the quick cut, and that maybe we don't necessarily have to assign this sort of fascist quality to speed or quickness. Because Tenzin, it was really interesting that you sort of described the anti-fascist quality of Wife of a Spy by invoking Heidegger, right? The irony there should not be lost on us.
Yes, and yes.
Heidegger's The Thin essay, he's basically like, you know, the problem with modernity is like, there's no sense of nearness. You know, the hydrogen bomb collapses all distance from subjectivity, blah, 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 right? So it's like, you know, Heidegger, the famous fascist philosopher, is already against like the quick speed from its conception.
Yeah, but I think anybody who studies Heidegger really deeply would say, I guess I shouldn't say anybody who, but I would say at least according to my reading of Heidegger, his philosophy of being in the world critiques, unbeknownst to him in his Black Book ramblings, the very narrative of fascism, right? Because the very idea that we're as beings caught up in movement and time defeats any notion of an ideology that stands over and above time, like Hitler thought the fascist state would last for 1,000 years, right? The very notion of being in the world critiques that. Like there's a certain way in which, and you find this in a lot of philosophers, Hegel too, right? Where the weight of their philosophical brilliance exceeds the particularity of their pejorative, racist, and, you know,
well, like their ideological blinders, right?
Yeah, like you in all these philosophers, they're all located in a time, and you can pick them apart and find their shortcomings, right? Like Kant said the horribly racist things in some of his tracts, and so did Heidegger, Hegel at various points, and even you know Nietzsche had his faults at times too, and various things he said. But then there's this brilliance, what makes them great philosophers in their what they lay out, that then deconstructs their own shortcomings and makes way for a new way to interpret them that exceeds them. And if it didn't do that, they wouldn't be able to be used, I think, in different times. You did particularly see that in Heidegger, because he was, yeah, a fascist. But his philosophy exceeds and deconstructs that fascism and makes way for deconstruction and other great movements in the 20th century.
And that's Tenzin's Nancy coming through, right? Right there. In a nutshell, yeah. Is it just okay, but the speed thing, right? So like think about Marinetti, right? Like in the Futurist Manifesto and then the Fascist Manifesto, right? There is a direct line, I think, between you know, mechanism and speed and fascism that I think you're right, Eddie, that it's maybe not a simple straight line, but I still think you know, there is a thread there that can be pulled, you know. And what's interesting to me, you know, and maybe we'll touch on this briefly with Jojo Rabbit when we talk about comedy. I just watched the Great Dictator again. And of course, the speech that ends that film is very much this, part of this speech is very much about, you know, this need to step back from speed and mechanization to reach the humanness behind them.
I'm also thinking it not only is it influenced by Hitchcock, but he's also influenced by Japanese film directors, like also is also notoriously famous for the slow motions in his films and anti-fascist films as well. I think there's a legacy there of Japanese cinema to use very slow motions, almost stillness, kind of composed images to deconstruct time. And also to show kind of the brevity with very slow, almost that would last forever kind of frames, but to show the brevity of human life and the kind of preciousness of it. So this film, with its slowness, also reminds me a bit of like Tokyo Story, which is also an anti-fascist film, of course, made much earlier. But I think that's another legacy, anti-fascist legacy of Japanese cinema. I think the director is following here.